Last week, former Taliban POW Bo Bergdahl broke his media silence about his reasons for abandoning his army unit by way of the popular Serial podcast. And just a few days later, the army made the decision to try Bergdahl for desertion and misbehavior before the enemy via a general court-martial, not the lower-level tribunal that had been recommended in the military's version of a preliminary hearing. Eric Montalvo is a former Marine Corps lawyer who spent 21 years as both a military prosecutor and defense attorney. He now works for the firm Federal Practice Group. In this week's Legal Loop, he talks with me about the latest developments in the Bergdahl case, including the Army's sudden decision to try the matter in a general court-martial, not a special court-martial.
A general court-martial is considered a felony-level court, generally, and that will only be referred to by a general officer or a convening authority bestowed on that special referral authority. So felony court issues associated with the general court-martial are typically reserved for the most heinous of crimes. A special courts-martial is focused on a misdemeanor-level offense. You may have the same exact charge, but the nature of the crime is such that it warrants being referred to a lower-level court. So what's interesting about the Uniform Code of Military Justice is you might have the same charge, same exact language, but the facts behind it may be a little different, and they could refer that same exact charge to either a non-judicial punishment administrative proceeding, the special court-martial misdemeanor, or the general court-martial. The big difference or distinction between the two courts-martial, in addition to the felony misdemeanor nature, is the type of confinement that you can receive. Special court-martials are capped at 12 months. You can get life or death in a general court-martial, and as you may be aware, Bergdahl is exposed to a life sentence, unlikely to receive, but is exposed to a life sentence based on the charges that look like they were referred.
And so in general, as you said, you can have the exact same charges in different types of court-martial, but the venue is usually determined by very fact-specific situations in each case. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. So, for example, you could have an assault case, and so you would look at an Article 128 assault, but if it's bound up into an alleged rape allegation, you're going to be in a general court-martial felony-level court. If it's simply, a pushing, shoving match, you find yourself in a special court-martial. So the facts drive the form determination, but what will look like almost identical charges can be referred to either venue.
And so, as we understand it, the decision to go with a general court-martial vice a special court-martial was made by the commander of Army Forcecom. Is that typically the level at which that kind of decision would be made, or is that unusual for the decision to go that high?
Well, I think what you're saying is intuitive, and that is, most general military discipline matters are handled at the lowest level possible. So, and that's the whole point of the military justice system, or was the point, and that is a disciplinary system. So to handle things at the lowest level, so at the company, the battalion, the brigade, what have you. And so to get it to this level is rare because typically generals are focused on, bigger, more important issues. In this particular case, given its public nature and the impact upon the force and all of the publicity surrounding it, I think that they raised it to a level where a higher level general would evaluate the merits of the case and its import and consequence upon the Army. So I think that they reserved that for higher level officer because of all the implications associated with the case.
And should we take from the fact that the original decision to overrule the recommendation from the Article 32 hearing, which was to use a special court-martial, should we see that as a signal that the general believes that the punishment should be more severe, or just the venue where the facts are going to be tried should have more latitude than a special court-martial?
Well, first, let's be really clear. The general is not indicating what type of punishment or consequence should befall the individual soldier by electing to move to a general court-martial. Mm-hmm. The Article 32 is simply a recommendation, and most of the time, the general officer or the commuting authority does not necessarily adhere to that recommendation. So what you're looking at is the general said, listen, the general nature of this set of offenses is such that it warrants a general court-martial. This is serious enough to take this to a general court-martial, and if proven, the consequence should be greater. So the consequence, if proven, should be greater than what a special court-martial can administer, and that's, I think, what they're looking at here.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned earlier that the life in prison sentence that we've all been reading about in the headlines is probably unlikely in this case. What do you think the range of likely sentences might be here?
Well, it's hard. This is a case that's not necessarily similar to many other cases, and misbehavior in front of the enemy, which seems to be looming in the background, hasn't been something that's really been charged, I think, in the last 40 years. So it's not something that I've seen regularly presented before court martial. So what you're facing is the judge that presides over this doesn't have a really good sentencing range to draw from. The members, if it goes to a panel, won't have a frame of reference. So they're going to try to compare and contrast the different issues in the case. I'll put those in threesome. One, the mitigation that may be available if he had mental health issues or any other mitigation, that may affect, the sympathy factor there, which has been referred to by a number of people in the process thus far. But on the other hand, the effect and deterrence value that may be there for anybody else who decides as a private that he's going to take hostage, the political consequence of combat and army leadership and put it in his hand and put people at risk. So I think you have competing narratives. If the narrative that prevails is, there's a code of conduct when you're a prisoner of war, there's a code of conduct as a soldier, and this person, ran as far from that in the tradition and history of service that he could, and he put people's lives in danger by, creating this situation that didn't need to exist, there's going to be a significant consequence, and I think that could, range from maybe 3-5 years if it's really aggravating and they could prove, harm to a force or people's deaths that seem to have been alluded to, that may, move beyond 5 years, but there's nowhere near going to be a life sentence. I find that unrealistic.
Yeah, that misbehavior before the enemy charge, you said it's exceedingly rare these days. Mm-hmm. What would the government need to show to prove that, and how is it different from the desertion charge?
Right. So when you're getting into the desertion charge, that is an offense, as I say, it happens in a moment. And so if they can prove that at a moment, his desire was never to return to the force, right? And so this idea that I'm not coming back, I'm out. If they can prove that at some moment he made that decision, even if he changed his mind later, the offense has occurred. And so it doesn't have to happen over a significant period of time. So the fact that he, sold things, took out money to leave, bought, civilian garments. I mean, all those things militate toward this idea of he didn't intend on coming back at least at some point. So if he gets that, there'll be a desertion conviction. And I don't know that that's going to be all that too hard. The misbehavior in front of an enemy is going to go through a much more strained and contorted, analysis, because you've got to determine what's an enemy. Are we at war as defined by the Uniform Code of Military Justice? And there are very specific definitions there. So I don't know that it's going to be that easy. I think the prosecution is probably relying on the aggravating nature of that offense to put that in front of the panel. And even if they don't get a conviction there, the facts and the aggravation around that are what's going to drive a higher sentence. So I think that this is more about not getting that particular conviction and prevailing, but to get the aggravating evidence in. Now, I will say that the reason podcast throws a wrench in the defense machine, because the fact that he's speaking out, Bergdahl, about him being Jason Bourne and all of this is very disconcerting and clearly aggravating, and it really gives the government a lot of ammunition to go after him and say, this is misbehavior. But soldiers aren't trained to do this. In fact, there's a code of conduct that says we're not supposed to be doing this type of stuff. And, he did it on purpose. So, he really gave him a chip in the game that I don't think they had necessarily. And, I'm curious as why that was done. But, here we are.
And as to that Serial podcast, anyone who has listened to it has heard in pretty great detail Bergdahl's claim that he did this because he felt there was a very significant and dangerous leadership failure within his chain of command, and that this was the only way to bring attention to it. Does that come into play at all, either as a defense before the panel or as a mitigating circumstance at sentencing?
Actually, I actually think it's aggravating. I think it's contrary. I think it will come in factually. These are statements against penal interest is what they call them, so stuff that doesn't help him. So I think those statements are going to come in the case in chief, the prosecution's case. I think that they're actually aggravating, not mitigating, and they're aggravating for this reason. You know, soldiers, you know, since we started this whole war thing, have complained about their bosses, right? I mean, people complaining about their bosses is not a unique thing. And, you know, there are ways to handle that. And there's an entire mechanism, as we know from the sexual assault crimes process. You know, the military has a very robust reporting system. And so there's a chain of command, there are IGs, there's congressmen. You can write to your congressman or senator. That's nothing but a stamp. You know, there are many, 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 many different ways for you to communicate to someone to say, hey, there's a problem here, news reporters for that matter. So, you know, for him to take this on his own and, you know, dictate and put other people and potential harm because he thinks that this was the best decision. I mean, that's you know, significant, and I do not think that's mitigating because what's the harm? What's the danger? What, you know, does he really have full information to make that assessment? How is he able to judge a general officer's actions when he knows not even a scintilla of what that general officer is making a decision on? So I don't think that's going to bear well for him. I don't think that people in the service, that's going to resonate well with them, and I actually think it's going to be an aggravator, and which leads me to, you know, is this kid going to actually get a fair hearing? Because there's not very many people who do not know what's going on in the service, and so picking a panel in this particular case, I think, is going to be very difficult. And so that's one concern I do have for him, is that, you know, because of the public nature of this and because him putting himself out there like that, he's really, you know, impacted, in my opinion, in an adverse way, his ability to get a fair panel.
Last thing, and I thank you for giving us so much time.
Yes, sir.
A lot of people have drawn a connection between the timing of the charging decision and the fact that he decided to speak out on this podcast just a few days earlier. Do you see any connection between those two things?
I do. I do, in the sense of it's not the timing or his desire to speak openly. I think it's the content of what he said. What he did, in my opinion, is he gave them the two parts to a crime. I'll keep it short. There's the mens rea and the actus rea. The mens rea is what you thought about when you were doing the crime, and the actus rea is what you did. There's no dispute of what he did. The question is what was in his brain at the time, and does that make him criminal? And so here he's saying, I knew about this. And I did it for this reason. And so the question of whether he was suffering from mental disease or defect is no longer there. The question of whether he knew what he was doing, or, you know, made a mistake or any of that other stuff, is gone. So what he's done is remove all doubt from the mens rea element of this and said, I knew what I was doing, and I did it on purpose. Now we move to what's the consequence, and that's where we're at. So from a prosecution or an Army standpoint, you can't have a private dictating policy, you know, to the administration or to the Army. I mean, that's just not how this works. And so for him to take that position, I mean, he really gave them an easier way through this, because they clearly were struggling. And then when he came forward with that information, I think it made their decision much more easier, because now it's like, okay, what does everybody else get? You know, if Bergdahl gets to walk away after all of this, and he did this on purpose, you know, what are we supposed to do with the rest of the soldiers who engage in much more minor misconduct and are still held accountable? I don't think it's fair. So for right now, he forced them into a position where they have to maintain some fairness here, and he had to be referred, because he removed any doubt as to, you know, what was going on there, because he said, if he told the truth, you know, why and what he did. And so now he's made the government's job pretty easy.
Eric Montalvo spent 21 years as a Marine Corps prosecutor and as a defense attorney. He's now with the Federal Practice Group here in Washington. It's easy to share this interview with your colleagues. Just go to federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive and click share with friends.